You're listening to Leadership in Action on Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School. Here again is Professor Mike Youssim, Jeffrey Klein, and Anne Greenhall.
Welcome back to Leadership in Action on Sirius XM's Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School. I'm your host, Jeff Klein, and I'm here along with my colleague and my co-host, Anne Greenhall. Our guest this segment, as we continue the 2016 coverage of the Littman Family Prize here at the University of Pennsylvania, our guest this hour is Vivek Maru, who is the Chief Executive Officer of Namati, a company that envisions a world where the power of law resides in the hands of people. Vivek, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. Good to see you guys.
Good to see you. And for our listeners, I'm sure it is certainly good to hear you. They can't see the large smile on your face right now. So Vivek, you founded this organization in 2011. Can you tell us a little bit, and that's only 5 years ago, I'm noting as I do math quickly in my head. Can you tell me about, you know, what were you doing in 2011, and what need did you see in the world?
This story goes back a little further.
Okay.
I lived in Sierra Leone for 4 years, right after the end of the Civil War there, so 2003 to 2007.
Mm-hmm.
And that brutal 11-year conflict, people agreed that among the root causes why people had gone to war in the first place were maladministration of justice, unfairness in the way government functioned, and there was an interest to do something to support people when they face injustice in their daily lives. And it was an open question what that would look like. There were only 100 lawyers in the country total. And out of that 100, more than 90 were in Freetown. And Sierra Leone has a kind of, like many places around the world, it has a dualist legal system where you have customary institutions based on African tradition, and then you have formal institutions inherited from the British who had colonized Sierra Leone. And so given those very particular circumstances, it was an open question what it would look like to provide some form of legal support when people face injustice in their daily lives. And I spent 4 years trying to experiment towards an answer and running this program called Team Up for Justice, which I co-founded with a Sierra Leonean lawyer, Simeon Karoma. And it was a kind of community paralegal model, these sort of barefoot lawyers who can be a bridge between formal legal promises and real life and understand the communities that they serve, be close to the context, and seek out concrete solutions to things like workers who've been denied their wages for years, or villages whose land has been damaged by a mining company. And to my surprise, at some point in this process, the World Bank read an essay. Someone from the World Bank read an essay we had written about this work and came and visited and ended up extending $1 million grant to expand the scope of this effort. And I had gotten tear gas protesting the World Bank when I was a law student. So,
so there's ironic. There's irony here for you.
I did not see this coming. Yeah, definitely did not see this coming. And not only did they contribute that $1 million, they which was a kind of an unusual investment for the World Bank, they convinced me to come and work for them. So I spent 3.5 years, yeah.
Is this a normal recruiting strategy for them?
I should ask them that. Like, do they do this on the regular? Yeah. This is how it happened to me. And I spent 3.5 years in what's called the Justice Reform Group at the World Bank, which is a relatively small, somewhat anomalous unit within that big institution that focuses on questions of rule of law. And I loved my, I'm thankful for my time there. I didn't mention the tear gas episode at the job interview.
Right.
and I really enjoyed it. One of the things that I loved was being able to work with governments as opposed to against them. You know, kind of a human rights guy, oftentimes you're sort of on the outside. And I learned so much from having governments as my clients and from seeing up close the kind of constraints that civil servants operate under.
Yeah.
It's easier to vilify them when you don't know them so well. And it turns out they are ordinary people like me and you, oftentimes operating under really severe constraints of their own. And a lot of them, if given the chance, will do the right thing. And so I just kind of came away from that experience with a more nuanced understanding of how these institutions work, what it takes to make them move. But
What a special opportunity, right?
Really?
I mean, to be able to derive that kind of perspective and add it to something. I mean, I can feel your passion for this just as we're sitting here talking about it. When you think about some of the assumptions that you held about civil servants or about governments, how did they change?
Yeah. To your point about it being a special opportunity, I went from riding a motorcycle village to village to having this much kind of wider view, and that was a stark change. And I'm grateful for those few years. I'm grateful for both. The time in Sierra Leone totally made me who I am, and what I'm doing today is basically a continuation of that. Mm-hmm. But then that interlude with the World Bank was also useful. Yeah, in terms of changing assumptions, it had to do with watching these reform efforts that are really aimed at the institutions themselves, how they play out, the ways in which they can go wrong and get caught up, and also how you could actually make things happen. One of my favorite people there is this woman, Young May Zhu, and she was working with the reestablishment of local government institutions in Sierra Leone after they had been shut down by one-party rule for decades. And then she was supporting the government to bring them back, run elections for the first time for local government and empower local government. And just watching her work was an example of how you could be dynamic and generate results even in a sort of big bureaucratic system.
That's great. Vivek, so just curious, why were you protesting the World Bank?
that was April 2nd, 2000, and it was part of the debt relief movement.
Oh.
And I still stand by 100% the principles that we were in the streets for then. And that was an interesting coalition. It was conservative Christians along with anarchists. It was a really big tent of people who had come together to say there's something wrong with the way we have structured this international finance regime. Yeah. Where people, let's say in the Congo, they had to suffer under a dictator who was taking World Bank loans and then parking them in Switzerland. And now they have to suffer again because a huge proportion of their tax revenue is going to service those loans that were sort of unwise in the first place. And my read is that mobilization that happened around that time had a big impact on the international financial architecture. And there was a significant amount of reform and debt relief that took place as a result of that pressure.
Mm-hmm. So you were on, as you said, on the outside and then on the inside and got maybe a more nuanced view of what it takes to make institutional change. Now, you left your position at the World Bank, and say, then what?
Now we're almost at 2011. Now.
Yeah, we're almost at 2011.
Right. So yeah, it took me a little while. I was just struck that there is an opportunity to really grow a global movement around what you might call legal empowerment. Mm-hmm. I often think of healthcare as an analogy where we have acknowledged for decades that healthcare isn't just about doctors. There's all these different actors in the system. There's nurses and midwives and community health workers. And in contrast, law, which is supposed to be this very special thing that is the language of our democracy that connects all citizens together, and yet law has been so closed. And there haven't been a multiplicity of actors. Lawyers really have had a monopoly in many countries and many systems on legal services and on the law. And it really occurred to me strongly during that time at the World Bank that there is an opportunity to grow a global movement around opening up the law and taking it out of books and courtrooms where it's oftentimes sort of sleeping and extending it to everyone.
And what was your insight on how to do that?
So the time in Sierra Leone, what we ended up doing was deploying what we call community paralegals. Mm-hmm. And we didn't invent this. It goes back a long way. In South Africa, starting in the 1950s, there were community paralegals in ANC offices, African National Congress offices who were helping people to navigate and survive that very codified system of apartheid. So there's this long tradition, and in Sierra Leone, we were experimenting with what that model looks like in the very specific circumstances of post-war country, dualist legal system. And so it's really these frontline advocates who Numathi champions, who can be an intermediary. They're sort of, for law, what community health care workers are for health care. And they have training in basic laws and in how systems work. And they are close to the communities they serve, and they help people to take on big practical challenges. For example, protecting community land rights in a situation where there's so much of a rush for land and natural resources, and there's people who live on land that they think of as their own, but they have no map, no piece of paper. A paralegal can help you to actually get secure tenure over those lands and set up proper governance arrangements over those lands so that you can manage them effectively and negotiate on equitable terms if an outsider does come.
Oh, very good.
And that,
Jeff?
I mean, that has to be such a difficult process or difficult system to negotiate without that kind of legal expertise, right? I mean, it reminds me of, I'm sure he's been an influence of yours, but of Hernando de Soto's work and the way that he analyzes capital systems, right? And what that means in terms of creating futures for yourself, for your families.
Yeah, I do feel like law is this thing that cuts through. Yeah. If you take everything we care about, all the big problems we face, protecting the environment, ensuring a fair and flourishing economy, delivering quality basic services, none of those things is achievable if the laws and systems only work for the most powerful.
Right.
We need a situation in which every single one of us can understand the law, make use of the law, and ultimately shape the law. And that's the sort of big vision we're aiming for.
Now, is there a significance to the name?
Numathi. I was going to ask.
Yeah. Numathi.
It's a Sanskrit word. And it means to bend something into a curve. And we were thinking of that famous quote from Dr. Martin Luther King, where he said that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice.
Oh, that's great. That was fantastic. Beautiful. So let me remind our listeners that you're listening to Leadership in Action. This is Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School, Sirius XM, Channel 111. And we are in the midst of continuing coverage of the Lippmann Family Prize award ceremony. And our guest this hour, this segment, is Vivek Maru, who is the Chief Executive Officer of Numathi. So, Vivek, what I'd love to be able to do right now is to, to take this important conceptual conversation that we're having and see if you can locate it in the impact that it has for people in the communities that you serve. So first, I'm going to ask you, if you would, just to describe some of the areas of the world that you're working in right now. And then if you could you pluck a story or two out of the last few years just to bring this work to life?
Yeah, absolutely. So in terms of where... We've got boots on the ground. We've got paralegals.
Do they wear boots?
Taking on injustices. They oftentimes wear long boots if they're riding motorcycles to stay out of the mud.
Right.
In India, Bangladesh, and Burma in South Asia. And in five countries in Africa, Sierra Leone, Liberia, Uganda, Mozambique, Kenya.
Got it.
And that number is growing. One of the big things we're working on this year is developing a paralegal effort among Syrian refugees in Jordan and Lebanon, who face huge amount of legal and justice challenges. And here in the United States, we're working on deepening our engagement on the access to justice crisis here in the United States. In addition to those boots on the ground, we convene the Global Legal Empowerment Network, which is 600 groups from 150 countries all over the world, all dedicated to legal empowerment. And we are really trying to foster learning and collaboration across that community, because we can't do this alone, and we really want to foster and encourage a strong global movement, a whole ecosystem of organizations who are taking up these approaches and solving justice problems and putting the law in people's hands. In terms of a story about what this looks like in practice, Sierra Leone, a couple years ago, there were 70 families in the east of the country who woke up one morning to find poles erected in the land that they have lived on and farmed for generations. Mm. And it turns out that a chief had sold 1,400 acres to a Chinese rubber company without asking the people whose land it was.
Mm. Oh, boy.
How are you going to do that, you know? Those families ended up standing up for themselves. They with the help of one of these paralegals and a single Sierra Leonean lawyer, Sonkita Conte, they navigated every step of a very complex legal process. And in February, something unusual happened. This one actually did go to court, which is a 1% solution for us. Most of the time, the paralegals are engaging administrative institutions. They're trying to come up with practical, low-cost remedies. Sometimes it's mediation. A lot of times it's using the administrative system. But in this case, those other methods failed, and we ended up having to go to court. And the high court ordered in February that all the land be restored to these families and that reparations be paid for the damage that was done. and that doesn't happen very often, but BBC right. Africa picked it up, and we got notes from all over the continent because these land grabs are happening all the time, but reversals are rare. And there's a woman, Fanta Nyanda, who one of the women whose land it was, and she said to us, "I now know the law is for us." Mm-hmm. And right. that's the transformation we're looking for. You know, we let the law be for all of us. Mm-hmm. Let it not be this abstract thing that's far away or threatening. Let it be something that every single one of us can take part in.
Mm. Vivek, we have a little bit of time left, and I'd just like to know a little bit about your personal history and how you got drawn to justice, the issue of justice.
Where do these things come from, these obsessions? I had a grandfather, my mother's dad, who was kind of a Gandhian. He had taken part in the Indian independence movement and spent some time in prison because of protests that he was part of. And then later after independence, he ran some sincere but unsuccessful campaigns for public office. And in the stories he told me when I was a young guy, I glimpsed this sort of beautiful and timeless struggle for social justice. And my own parents were immigrants. And I think, like many immigrant families, you know, had a very strong service ethic, but less involvement in structural questions. And so maybe it sort of skipped a generation, or I certainly definitely looked to my grandfather for inspiration.
And was your interest well received by your parents?
Oh man, I have the best parents on earth. But they didn't necessarily compute or make sense of what I was aiming to do from the beginning. But over time, they've become huge supporters.
You did go to law school.
I did go to law school.
So that answers the traditional trajectory.
Right. Sounds official.
Good.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
I did go
there. My son, the lawyer.
But my grandmother used to say, "Lawyer is liar." That was like her thing. So the specific community I come from, we're from Kutch, which is like the western corner of India. And the things that they say it takes to be a man are, they say three things: a house, a wife, and a business. Even if you're selling coconuts off a little cart, you should be able to run a business. And so law didn't necessarily fit, though now that we've got a little organization, 100 people, maybe I also managed to get married, so maybe I finally am starting to qualify.
And an honoree, Lippmann Family Prize.
And I think you're a relatively new father as well, is
yes,
that right?
I've got a two-year-old, little guy named Luca. Yeah.
How has that changed, if at all, your perspective towards the work or the trajectory of the organization?
Most of the time, I'm trying to convince him to eat his food rather than wear his food, you know, or that he should, like, if he wants to make friends with someone, the way to do that is not by beating on them, you know. Mostly we're having those kinds of conversations. But at night, when I am putting him to sleep, I think about the world I want for him.
Yeah.
You know, and I want a more fair, a more just world for Luca. And this work of legal empowerment, I believe it'll help us get there.
It's great. Very good.
So I love this. Here's the way I'd maybe say it. I feel like there's a lot of momentum right now for your work, for Namati in general. You were named an Ashoka Fella in 2014. This is the part that I love. You were named a legal rebel.
Isn't that funny?
By like the least rebellious, or the American Bar Association. So who are the other legal rebels? I'd like to know. and then, you know, to be here today as one of the Lippmann Family Prize honorees. And I know you also just received a Skoll Fellowship. I mean, there is a lot of momentum. You know, you're attracting a lot of attention to the work. So what do you think the next 5 years, the next 10 years are going to look like?
Great question. Yeah, we're so grateful for those moments of recognition. I think historically, law and justice has not been central, especially when we think about development, for example. Yeah. That there was a Millennium Development Goals adopted in 2000. Very right. Laudable things. Let's reduce child mortality, increase access to clean water, yeah. increase access to education. But there was no mention of law or justice or fairness or accountability. Mm-hmm. Those things were left out altogether. And the goals were very influential on policy and on spending. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that we argued over the last couple of years was those original goals expired in 2015, uh-huh. and there was a conversation about what the next global development framework would be. And our argument has been that we've made serious progress against those original MDGs, but we're far behind what justice demands. Mm-hmm. And to get there, we need to take justice seriously. Mm-hmm. Justice and law need to be at the heart of how we think about development. And by development, I mean, you know, improving human well-being. And so one of the important victories for our whole movement was that the new sustainable development goals that were adopted in the fall, they include goal 16 out of 17, just made it in.
Yay. Mm-hmm.
And it commits to access to justice for all, which is an important recognition,
yeah.
and a historic recognition by governments around the world that you can't improve, people can't improve their lives if they can't exercise their rights. And so looking forward, what I would like to see is armies of community paralegals who are making that abstract ideal a reality for people around the world.
All right, a final question for you, if I can. You know, for our many listeners, right, who come from all walks of life, who work in businesses, who work in nonprofits, who work in governments. You know, I noted earlier that you have such passion when you speak about this kind of work. What advice do you have for them? Mm. You know, for people, you know, who clear every person I've ever met, right? Yeah. Every person who exists has a passion,
yes.
for something. How should they think about building that passion into their lives, into their careers?
Mm.
We like to end with the easy ones.
Yeah. One piece of advice is that I honestly feel like these issues of law cut across every aspect of society, mm-hmm. and we have a network dedicated to legal empowerment. So if these issues in particular are part of their passion, I would invite them to come and join us. Yeah. Namati.org, it takes 2 seconds. You can join the network, be in conversation with people around the world who are grappling with these questions. And then and more generally, you know, mm-hmm. someone might be passionate about sports or about early childhood education. Two things come to mind. One is something that Brian Stevenson, who's a hero to me, someone who's been fighting mass incarceration in the United States for 2 or 3 decades. One of the principles he talks about is proximity. Mm-hmm. Get close, you mm-hmm. know? So for example, if you're interested in injustice is happening everywhere. It's happening here in Philadelphia. Get close to it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And by getting close to the thing that you're passionate about, insights will emerge. And then the other one that I especially tell students who I meet, young people who I meet, is try to write about what you find out, because there's a certain discipline in writing. It forces you to think clearly. It forces you to work yourself through a problem.
Yeah.
And so, and today there's more and more ways in which that writing can actually reach others. Mm. And so those are two pieces of advice for what it's worth.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Proximity. I really like that.
I like that.
Get close.
Yes.
Vivek, we want to say congratulations on being named a 2016 Lippmann Family Prize honoree.
Thank you so much.
And we also want to say thank you for the work that you and everyone at Namati do on behalf of those who don't have the same access to legal services and legal expertise as many of the world's more powerful do. So thank you for your work.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Anne.
Thank you.
Great to talk to you guys.
All right. So we have been talking with Vivek Maru at Namati. And as he noted, you can learn more about the organization at Namati. That's namati.org. Coming up, we will continue our coverage of the Lippmann Family Prize here on the University of Pennsylvania's campus. And we're going to hear from Henry Timms, who's been a frequent guest here on our show. He is the executive director of the 92nd Street Y and also the founder of the Giving Tuesday movement, which has generated an abundance of resources for nonprofit and social sector organizations around the world. So please stay tuned. Henry, as always, will be provocative as he talks about new power. I am Jeff Klein. I'm here with Anne Greenhall, and this is Leadership in Action on Sirius XM Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School.